Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have here in the studio Garth Greenwell. Garth, welcome. Welcome to WCBN.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I should say you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And we're here on a lovely September afternoon. You're no stranger to Ann Arbor, Garth. This is a sort of a return of sorts. But is it your first time coming to the university to read for as part of the Zell Visiting Writers series?
It is. When I lived in Ann Arbor from 2006 to 2009, when I was teaching high school at Green Hill School, I came to the events. I came to the series. But yeah, this is my first time coming to read.
Oh my gosh. I thought you looked familiar. You know?
you absolutely saw me. Yeah. Because you would have been in the program
MFA
then.
Program, yeah.
You absolutely saw me then.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I went to all the events.
Oh, that's amazing. And you're here being the events. You're the reason for the season here as we gather tomorrow at the Helmut Stern Auditorium. You'll be doing a reading and a Q&A at 5:30 to 7. Will you be reading from Small Rain, the book that we have on the table?
I will be reading from Small Rain.
That's great. And then you also have the craft lecture on Friday.
Friday morning, that's right.
And that will be in the Union, in the Michigan Union at 10. I wrote this down. 10 a.m.
I think
to
it
11,
is at 10 a.m., yeah.
In the Wolverine Room.
Oh,
so
great.
That sounds great.
Great.
Right? So,
yeah.
The title for the craft lecture on Friday is Daddy Augustine Against Autofiction.
Yeah.
Can you give us a preview?
Yeah. Sure. So I was thinking about this. You know, titles are the bane of my existence. I hate them. I feel so bad at them. They're always the last thing to come. But I love the title Daddy Augustine. I think it's such a great title. And for years, all I have known about the essay that title will eventually attach to is the title. And it's the last essay I need to write for my next book, which is a book of essays, which I have promised to give to my editor by the end of the year. And months ago, when they asked me to give the title for my talk, I gave this title thinking, well, that will force me to have some, you know, at least 45 minutes worth of remarks around this idea. So that's what I have, and that's what I'll be presenting on Friday.
Because you knew in like the arc of how this collection of essays was unfolding.
That's right. You know, the basic idea is that, I think the literary tradition I aspire to began with Augustine's great book, Confessions, which is, I think, my favorite book. And actually, so this talk is the first step toward writing the essay. The second step, in November and December, I'm teaching a six-session online course on the Confessions, which I first read in my early 20s and have read and reread since. And when I hear people describe my work and the work of some of my contemporaries as using this word autofiction, I feel really alienated by that. Like it doesn't describe for me anything that feels essential to my practice. And so this essay is really an attempt to articulate what I think is a more genuine tradition of writing interiority and writing consciousness using tools that Saint Augustine invented.
So in the Confessions, you're saying,
yes,
which I read a long time ago in undergrad. I did read that one.
Yeah.
It's to me, I think when I read it, I wasn't clear about maybe the elements of invention then, because at least if we're looking at your work in relation to the Confessions in considering interiority of, mm-hmm. of the character, it feels like in your practice, invention is a key component.
Absolutely, it is.
Which is different, I would say, than trying to get closer to the idea or the feeling or the experience with the use of language. Or is that not? Is that, how are you defining invention? Because with Augustine, I guess I should say, I thought, oh, this is more like his, you know, it's more, he wouldn't want to call it fiction.
Well, right. You know, so,
at all.
So this is the thing. So, you know, we talk about that book as being the first modern autobiography, which I think is fair enough, but it doesn't capture how weird a book it is and how heterogeneous a book it is. You know, yes, Augustine tells the story of the first 33 years of his life, but it is equally full of biblical exegesis, of philosophical and theological experiment and speculation. It's also, I mean, the entire book is a prayer. And, you know, the project of the book, what that book accomplishes, which I do think Augustine invented, is a way of making thinking itself dramatic, making thinking a narrative event. And it's that, I think, you can trace the influence of that and the development of those tools through a tradition that passes through the mystics, that passes through the essay tradition with people like Montaigne and Thomas Brown. I think Augustine is like the seed of, in late 19th century, the philosophical movement or tendency or practice we talk of as phenomenology, which is a sort of attempt to explore kind of the structure of existence, of everyday experience. And then it enters the novel. I think, and all of this can be contested, and I think people can trace other paths.
Hey, but this is your hour, Garth.
Right? This is my...
This is my essay,
my daddy, Augustine. Yeah. But, you know, it enters the novel, I think, not so much in the first person as in close third person point of view. And close third person, which in many accounts of sort of what the modern is in the modern novel, it is close third person POV. And I think one place, I mean, I think there's a very particular place, at least in the English language novel, where this, what I call, following a philosopher named Charles Taylor, radical reflexivity that Augustine invented, enters the novel, is chapter 42 of Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. And in Henry James, and in that chapter, which Henry James recognized he had done something really special, and, you know, something that I think transformed his work, because he figured out there how to make the adventure of his novels not external event, which in Portrait of a Lady, you know, the plot of Portrait of a Lady is this young American girl, Isabel Archer, is asked by a lot of guys to marry her, and she says no, and then no, and then yes. That's the whole plot. She says no, no, yes. The rest of the novel is about her understanding of what those actions mean and what that decision to say yes to someone means. And in chapter 42, she's just sitting in a chair by the fire. There is no external action. It's all in her mind, and she's surveying her life. And the sort of adventure, the drama, is how she understands her life. That is what I think we call now the novel of consciousness. And what I see my work as aspiring to is that tradition of fiction writing, the tradition of the novel of consciousness. And that goes all back to Daddy Augustine.
Yeah. Well, when I started reading Small Rain, Garth, I thought so much of the way the prose is moving feels like a poem to me. Like, I felt like, oh, these are like, you know, and so it wasn't a surprise to me that then that you have written poems, that you've studied poetry,
yeah.
that that part of you in your acknowledgement section is like a debt of gratitude to James Lagenbach, you know.
My first poetry teacher. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting to hear you talk about like identifying Henry James in this chapter 42 and putting that, because to me, I don't have the breadth of like what you're looking at to find your place within this experience and what you're writing and working on now, Garth. But to me, I also always go back to like Joyce and Ulysses and what he's doing.
Absolutely. Joyce, the good Catholic who absolutely grew up reading Augustine. Yeah.
And so that might, and then did it on such a massive scale.
Yes.
You know, but I think I would have to think much more about it before I could have a conversation with you about it. But like to see the departures from, like what makes that maybe more inaccessible or more radical or or not in in relation to what you're saying, which is so it's very exciting to hear. And I love your title, like Against Autofiction, because I felt like so many people are wanting to embrace that more and more in the last like 5 to 10 years or so, or acknowledge something that may have been part of a practice or a side part. But to be,
I mean, the problem is what autofiction is. And, you know, I mean, autofiction is a term that was invented in the 1970s by a French writer named Serge Dubrovsky, who was responding to a critic who had said that a fictional work with a protagonist who had the same name as the author was a kind of logical impossibility. And Serge Dubrovsky wanted to write into that logical impossibility. And so I think that's important because he was not naming a tradition. He was not identifying something. He was instead, he felt, writing something new, you know, making a break from tradition. And, you know, this, and then this term becomes popularized in the Anglophone world much later. You know, really, I think in the last 15 years, it has been popularized and it has become a brand, you know, and that is just hugely alienating. You know, I think it matters that artists are able to articulate the traditions in which they're working, because those traditions are sources of power. You know, I mean, they're moral sources. They're places where we get a sense of the scale of our aspirations. And it matters whether one thinks that one's practices have to do with social media and a sort of, you know, culture of narcissism, and that one is doing something invented by, you know, a Norwegian guy, you know, Knausgaard, or, you know, something that is really very shallow in terms of its access to history, when really these tools go back to St. Augustine. You know, they're 1600 years old. They're at the heart of the literary tradition. They're not something that you get to put a label on and brand and market and make money from for a while before you dismiss it as a fad.
Right. Or move through it.
Yeah.
Just using it for a label.
Yeah.
Until something else suits.
That's right. That's right.
Let's take a short break. And then when we come back, we'll talk more. And we'll hear some of Small Rain, the book on the table with us, Garth Greenwell's latest novel. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We've got Jason Behind the Glass.
Thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Garth Greenwell is here in the studio. His book, his novel, Small Rain, now out in paperback with Picador, is on the table with us. And I guess I was admiring your hardback from FSG that was out last year.
That's right, yeah.
So it's nice to see both objects in the world, Garth. Could you tell us a little bit about the music that we're hearing for the breaks today?
Sure. Yeah. So this is music taken from a Renaissance mass by John Taverner called the La Marmée Mass. And it's a piece of music that appears in an important scene in the novel.
And for the character, would you mind saying a little bit about what makes it important?
Yeah, so actually, and I'm sorry, I misspoke. I was looking at the page of the novel. It's not La Marmée, it's instead the Western Wind Mass. And Western Wind is a poem which was also a song. And the Western Wind Mass is built on the melody of this popular song. So it's like if you imagine a mass written to like a Beyoncé song, you know, to a popular song, that's how this worked. But it's the poem, which is where this phrase small rain is taken from. That is a poem that the narrator of the novel, who's a poet and also a teacher of poetry, has taught again and again and again. And it's a very short poem. It's Western wind, when wilt thou blow? The small rain down can rain. Christ, if my love were in my arms and I in my bed again. And this poem accompanies the narrator as he, you know, the novel begins with the narrator struck down by an annihilating pain. And it recounts the 8 or 10 days he spends in the ICU. And this poem is one of the things that accompanies him in that time in the hospital.
Thanks, Garth. So before we get back to the conversation and hear a part, so we can hear the prose in Small Rain, I'll read your short bio that is in Small Rain. Garth Greenwell is the author of two previous works of fiction, Cleanness and What Belongs to You, the recipient of honors including a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Harold D. Vercel Memorial Award for Prose Style from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's currently a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. And Small Rain, the book that we do have on the table with us today, everyone, is the 2025 Penn Faulkner winner for the award for fiction. That must have been pretty exciting, too.
It was exciting. It was a big surprise. And yeah, you know, I mean, I think when you're working, you know, you have to recognize that prizes do not correlate to value. And when you live in the world of books, you see that, you know, great books go totally unseen and books win prizes that you think aren't deserving of them. So, you know, it's not, I don't want to give it sort of more importance than it has, but it, you know, I was very moved to have been selected by a number of writers who I admire. And it is a prize with a long and rich history. So I feel very honored to sort of be among those writers and also among the other finalists this year who were extraordinary writers. It was an honor to get to stand beside them. Yeah.
And your debut also has won, well, both novels before Small Rain have had their share. But your debut, I think, got a British writing
It honor. Did, yes. It won the British Book Award for Debut of the Year, and it was also actually a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. So that was also a lovely kind of return.
And speaking of returns, you have written so far an interconnected series of novels that can be read standalone, which I can attest to. Because I was late to the party, Garth. I only today learned that the narrator in Small Rain is we first would meet in What Belongs to You and then again in Cleanness as we're moving through the chronology of this man's life.
That's right. But you're also quite right that the books stand alone. And, you know, something that appeals to me, at least right now, is this idea of kind of books that hopefully make a kind of pleasing, satisfying, formal shape on their own, but also that intermingle in a way. And so, you know, I think if you have read the other books, there will be sort of points of, I hope, particular pleasure of kind of recognition of certain moments, but the books stand alone. And the best thing about books is that they don't expire. So there's no such thing as being late to the party.
Oh, that's right.
I'm just happy you, I mean, it makes me very happy to hear you describe it as a party. I like that. You know, the book's kind of partying and we can join in when we want.
And I think, and it was also so lovely to learn that your novella that you wrote in, I think,
like 2010, 2011, yeah.
Yeah, becomes the first part of your first novel.
That's right. You know, I was, so I guess the trajectory is really that, you know, I was very much on a kind of path to being a poet, a kind of literary person. I took my first poetry class when I was a junior in college with this man, James Langenbach, who really changed my life. I had been studying music before that. And then immediately after undergrad, did an MFA in poetry at WashU in St. Louis. And then immediately started a PhD program in poetry. It was really on this path to sort of, you know, a certain kind of poet professor, the kind of poet professor that my first teacher, James Langenbach, had kind of modeled. But then after 3 years of the PhD program, I realized that I was in a life that I didn't want. And I quit and I took a job teaching high school here in Ann Arbor at Green Hill School. And, you know, thinking actually that maybe after a year I would go back to my PhD program. But it turned out that I just fell in love with my students and with teaching. And it was a really exhausting and difficult, but also exhilarating year. And so I stayed. And then after 3 years at Green Hills, three really good years at Green Hills, I decided to make another leap. And I took a job because I had always wanted to live abroad and had never, my first time traveling abroad was helping to chaperone a group of students to France after my first year of teaching high school.
But I'd always, oh my gosh, that would be.
That was a real experience.
That would be
the most harrowing thing I've ever done is like been responsible for 12 high school kids in the Paris metro. Like that was a terrifying.
What were you thinking, Garth?
Terrifying thing. It's a good question. But you know, I took a leap and I took a job teaching high school in Bulgaria, in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria. I had no connection to Bulgaria. It was just where the job was. And it was there.
Seriously.
I'd know, you know, I just wanted to be elsewhere. And it, you know, I looked into the job. I looked into the school. It's a school called the American College of Sofia. It's the oldest education. It's the oldest American educational institution outside of America.
That's why I thought you picked it.
Yeah. No, I didn't pick it. It was just there.
It just happened to be.
And, you know, and it was founded to educate Bulgarian kids. So it's an American school, but not an international school. It's a school for Bulgarian kids. And I just thought, and, you know, it's in the capital, you live in Sofia. And I just thought that would be an interesting and rewarding experience. And it was there that I started writing fiction. I had never written fiction before. And what would become the novella Mitko and then the first section of What Belongs to You, that was the first fiction I had ever written.
Why do you think that became that, like the avenue of like thinking about art as a way of thinking about your life or explore, right?
Yeah.
And why do you think fiction became what it was rather than poems, something that you were maybe used to?
Yeah. You know, it's a really good question, and I don't have a good answer for it. When I arrived in Bulgaria that first semester, I finished a collection of poems and put it in the drawer and thought I wouldn't write anything for a while. And then realized that I was feeling sentences that weren't broken into lines. It's the only way I can put it. I think it really had a lot to do with teaching high school. I think teaching high school, you know, after a PhD program where my most intense relationships were with books and the most urgent things to me were my thoughts about those books, to be put in front of, you know, 80 14-year-olds was a shock.
Right.
And it made me be interested in other people and in the external world in a way I had never been before. And then on top of that, to move to Bulgaria, where, you know, I had an experience of just utterly falling in love with Sofia, with the city, and with the language. And I think those two things, high school teaching and living abroad, somehow combined to make me need prose, but I really don't understand it.
Were you learning Bulgarian when you were there, or were you speaking English in the school?
I taught in English, but I tried very hard to live in Bulgarian, and I worked very hard to learn the language, and it was really important to my experience there that I became proficient in Bulgarian and could have friendships and relationships with people who didn't speak English.
Yeah, that sounds vital.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And also vital was being a gay person in Bulgaria and, you know, that opening up, like forms of queer sociality, opening up a path to intimate relations that I wouldn't have been available to me otherwise.
In Small Rain, the narrator speaks about many gay men who were expats writers, like this tradition of, yeah. And I love that part.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. You know, this tradition of queer writing, of expat writing, of the tradition of the American abroad, you know, James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room was a crucial novel for me. All of that. Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that motivated the writing of What Belongs to You was that I wanted to have a conversation. I wanted to join a conversation happening among those writers in those books.
And have you done it?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's something you ever accomplish, but it is, you know, one of my motivations. You know, I mean, these are books that were so, I mean, Giovanni's Room saved my life when I was a 14-year-old kid in the pre-internet American South.
When you were 14,
I found it,
Garth.
When I was 14. I actually, just this week in the new issue of Harper's, I have a long essay on Giovanni's Room where I try to make sense of this long relationship I've had with this book. And I do think one of the reasons one writes is because, you know, reading something like Giovanni's Room, you have a profound sense of an intimate relationship you form with the book and with the writer. And writing a book is a way to speak into that intimate relationship.
Thanks, Garth. Let's take a short break. We'll hear some more of The Western Wind. Today on Living Writers, Garth Greenwell is here. His novel, Small Rain, is on the table with us. You will hear some of it in the next quarter. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Oh.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Garth Greenwell is here. Small Rain, the book on the table with us. Garth, would you mind reading from Small Rain?
Oh, I'd be happy to. I'm going to read from very early in the novel. So as I said, the novel begins with the narrator experiencing just an annihilating pain. And eventually, when he finally goes to the ER, they discover that something very serious, very grave has happened to him, which is a tear in his artery, in his aorta. And I'm going to read just from a moment when he's being examined by the vascular surgeon. Her name was Ferrier. She had mentioned it before, but it hadn't registered. I was surprised by it now. It was the name of one of my favorite singers, Kathleen Ferrier, whose recordings I had listened to endlessly, one of the first CDs I bought as a teenager just after I discovered music, classical music, I mean, was a recording of Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde and three of the Rückertlieder, the first of which became a kind of talisman for me, important in a way I was only just beginning to understand art could be important. The song articulated something that had been inarticulate before, but it did more than that, too. It created something. It didn't just light some chamber of myself that had been dark. It made a new chamber somehow. It made me capable of some feeling I couldn't have felt before. It humanized me, I want to say. It was part of that humanization art has been for me, which is something else it has become difficult to say or believe, but I do believe it. The surgeon began her examination just below my ribs, pressing very hard, first with the palm of her hand and then shifting the pressure to her fingers. She repeated this, moving slowly, asking each time if it hurt. It didn't at first, not really, but I stiffened anyway. She wasn't causing pain, but she was seeking it. That was her goal, and she continued until finally I gasped. She lifted her hands just slightly, reducing the pressure. "There it is," she said. "I'm sorry. I need to go a little farther," she went on. "I know it hurts, but is it all right if I keep going?" And I gave a quick nod. Even before Ferrier begins to sing, in the introduction, when the clarinet enters against the English horn, there's a moment that's like a key slipping into a lock, and there's a line almost at the end that for me is where the key turns, at least as Ferrier sings it. I didn't know any German when I first heard it. I didn't know any languages, but I learned the words, "Ich bin gestorben dem Weltgetümmel und ruh in einem stillen Gebiet." They were written in the little CD booklet alongside a translation, "I am dead to the world's tumult and rest in a quiet realm." At the start of the second line, "und ruh," the voice rises a minor third, F to A flat, in the comfortable middle of the voice, nothing virtuosic or spectacular, but it creates a dissonance against the C minor chord in the orchestra. At the same moment, the double basses slide down to a C, the cellos join them, the fifth is in the second violins, and the voice keens a half step above them. Except that it isn't keening, not quite, or not only. The violin's G is an octave below the voice, and they're holding the note from the previous bar. They don't reassert it. "I'll be quick," the surgeon promised, and she was, though she wasn't any more gentle. Maybe she couldn't be. Around my navel, the pain was intense. I squeezed my eyes shut, and then it faded a little lower down. Where she dug her fingers into the top of my pelvis, there was hardly any pain. Ferrier leans into the word "who," rest. Not dramatically, but her voice becomes electric with longing and resignation. There's such intensity and restraint that the note asserts itself, so that as Mahler extends the dissonance, your sense of harmony is unsettled, or mine is anyway. The A flat creates an alternative harmony. Just for a moment, one can hear a major chord against the minor. I didn't understand this when I first heard the song. I would study the score later in music school, and really, it didn't help me understand what I had felt when I first heard it. How can I say what it did to me? It unmade me, unmade and remade me around itself somehow.
Thank you, Garth. Thank you. Thanks for choosing that particular passage to read today.
You know, so much of the book is about art and the value of art and what it means to have devoted one's life to art. And you know, the drama of the book really is that, you know, this man who has always been healthy, who's in his early 40s, and who is then told one of the first things he hears once they discover what's wrong with him in the ER is that he could die. And, you know, that presence, that pressure of the possibility of death, it puts a question on, it puts a pressure on his whole life. And he finds himself asking, okay, if this is it, what has my life meant? And, you know, his whole life has been a gamble that a poem or a piece of music has a value that is infinite and that you can pour your life into it and that value will be poured back into your life and that it's a value that is inexhaustible. And in these days that he spends, especially early in the time when it's clear that the doctors are very worried about him, you know, he's going to find out if that gamble will pay off. Can art help us live? Can art give our lives value?
And can he continue?
Well, will he? Will he get to go home? You know. And one of the reasons I wanted the book to start with Western Wind, that little poem, and one of the reasons the title comes from that poem, it only appears on that page. It never comes back in the book. But that second half, you know, Christ, if my love were in my arms and I in my bed again, that sort of longing to be back home. Well, when this narrator is in his hospital bed, which basically he never leaves for the entirety of the novel.
Maybe a little bit to the chair.
Exactly. He gets to shift to the chair for 30 minutes a day. You know, the place that he longs for is his bedroom in his little Midwestern house and the bed where his partner, he knows, is longing for him.
Where L is,
yeah, the man he shares his life with.
And so in a way, it's having a renewal of what your life could be.
Well, you know, I think...
Or is, or a re-seeing, or a seeing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, you know, narrator, guy in his early 40s, you know, he is the same narrator as the first two books. And the first two books really are books of adventure. They're books about someone who's on a geographical adventure, he's living abroad. They're books about even more erotic adventure. And now in this third book, you know, in his early 40s, he finds himself in a little Midwestern college town, 7 years into a kind of relationship he had never imagined he would have. And, you know, a couple of things. I mean, on one hand, I think he's a little disappointed by that. And I think he's a little, you know, not in a dramatic or tragic way, but I think, you know, maybe just the fact that his life is his life, you know, one life, not 20, you know, when you're in your 20s and life is just this open field of possibility. When you're in your 40s, you have a sense of like, oh, okay, this is my life. It's, you know, probably not going to change in a dramatic way. And there's something maybe for a lot of people a little disappointing about that, even if you know you're lucky and you know it's a good life. And then even
more.
And
you've created it.
And you've created it. You've chosen
it. You've been lucky enough to do towards it.
That's right. And also, I think, you know, in our existence day in, day out, in a long relationship with someone, living with someone day in and day out, I think it is very hard not to become a little dulled to your own life. I think it's very easy to sort of stop seeing it. And one of the things that this illness does, that in a weird way, you know, I mean, it takes that life away from the narrator. And in a kind of paradoxical way, in taking that life away from him, it gives his life back to him. Because, you know, as he faces the possibility that he might not ever get out of that hospital bed, he can see how wondrous that life is. And, you know, that life lights up to him. And I hope, you know, the long trajectory, the sort of long narrative of the book, I hope is his coming to see that this life that from, if you look at it, you know, in one way might seem mundane, a little boring, a life of repetitions, that actually it too is a life of adventure. And that the attempt, that attempt at sort of long knowing of someone and this shared project of building a life with someone, that that too accommodates wonder and revelation, you know? And that's an extraordinary gift that this very bad thing that has happened to him gives him.
And yes, thank you, Garth, for this, because it makes me also wonder if the next, if you will have a next novel where this character continues. But I might put a pin in that to ask you that in a moment, because I don't want to move too far from the passage yet, because of the presence of the music and the presence of art being a force that's creating a life. Like, it's one of the ways that you can create a life, like a meaning, because so many people may say, what is, and maybe us too sometimes, like, what is art for, or, you know, on the whole. But here there's a clear way this character is understanding art as a way of becoming a self, who you could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, art gives us access to our own existence. And, you know, certainly, like, it was important to me.
That's a simple thing that you just said out loud, but it's not a simple thing when you think about what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that question of, like, you know, what does it mean to live authentically? What does it mean to have access to your life? I mean, that is the question of the book, you know. Do we have to have a sense of sort of death being right in front of us for life in all of its wonder to light up? Or are there ways to capture that? And I think art is a way to capture that. You know, I mean, so much of the time in our lives, and I spend part of each year in New York, and I feel this so strongly in New York, that, like, just to survive walking down the street in New York, I have to, like, shut down so much of my sensory apparatus and also so much of my moral apparatus. You know, I have such a sense of just how immense the amount of suffering is on any block of Manhattan, that, you know, just to survive, you have to shut yourself down. I think that is devastating to us as human beings. I mean, I think that is we dehumanize ourselves. We alienate ourselves from our own humanity, from access to our own experience when we do that. And yet so often we feel that that's the only way we could. I mean, how can you exist in the world open to all of the suffering of the world? And one thing that art lets us do is put a frame around a little piece of reality, a little piece of existence, delimit it. And within that boundary, within that frame, when Cézanne is painting an apple, he can engage with that bit of existence in the fullness of his capacities, of his sensory capacities, of his moral capacities. That's something that art does for us. And it gives us a space, it gives us an arena in which we can engage with our own existences in the fullness of our humanity. And I do think that's one way in which art is essential to our, to any access we have to an authentic life.
To the maker, as you speak of with Cézanne, but as well as to the person who comes to the art, the person listening to the music, the person seeing the apple.
Yeah, or the person reading the poem.
The person reading Small Rain.
Or the person, I mean, that is the hope, you know. Mm-hmm. And
you say you hoped doctors and other caregivers read Small Rain.
I do hope that. You know, I think it is so easy. So much of the hospital is set up to turn patients into kind of mechanisms. And, you know, and I have complicated feelings about this because...
Your beautiful lines where when the character realizes that they are part of a machine.
That's right. Yeah, because they're bound, they're you know, sort of wired up to all of these machines, and that they themselves have become a kind of machine, and that they're being touched in all of these ways that treat them like a mechanism. And that's a complicated thing, because like if a surgeon treating me as a machine, as a mechanism, allows them to save my life, I am all for
it. Exactly.
But he becomes hypersensitive. You know, he's being touched all the time. And he becomes hypersensitive to the way that so much of those touches, those kinds of touch, feel sort of depersonalizing. They take away his personhood. And that means in those moments, like there's a moment early in the book where a nurse touches his ankle. And, you know, that, which has no instrumental purpose, it's not to do anything, it's not to give him a shot, it's not to take any measurement, it's just to sort of be a human being with another human being. And that restores personhood to him. Or when his, you know, this is all happening in the early days, pre-vaccine days of COVID. And so even though his illness has nothing to do with COVID, COVID inflects the experience. And his partner can only be with him for an hour or two a day. And otherwise, he's just, you know, ICU is already isolating, and he's even more isolated. And when his partner touches him, he has a different access to his personhood than he does the rest of the time. And that's, you know, he becomes aware of that.
And so... part of, because I feel like Small Rain is going to be something that people, artists, writers, musicians, like being able to read some of these passages that show the interior process or being of this character will love and will feel like recognition within in some ways, or challenge, you know, or some, right? But I feel like that's why it struck me that you said, but this book also can be this other thing, because it's like a cultural witnessing in it. Well, you didn't say that, so I don't mean to say that, putting words that, but it, in a way, for this time period, it's hard to write about this time period, this political time period, what's happening with the pandemic, with COVID, how... And this is one way of doing it. And you chose to do it in, well, I'm not saying this quite right, but how this book is created is in a space, like a contained space of 8 or 10 days in this hospital. And, but which the political climate is there, the also the political climate of care itself in the United States.
Right.
Is what I think we're speaking to.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my ambition in the book, I wanted to write what it was like to be an embodied consciousness, you know, an embodied person in this moment, in this place. And that project, even though it might sound apolitical, and in some, in a certain regard, I feel very strongly a need a desire to protect art making from the imperatives of politics. I think those are separate endeavors. But of course, any time you try to describe a particular body in a particular place, of course that is embedded in politics. And it matters that any time he turns on the TV in his hospital room, he sees police violence. It matters that this hospital is overtaxed and understaffed because nurses and doctors are quitting because it is so devastating to be a medical professional during COVID, and because they're you know, just impossible demands are being made of them. It matters that, you know, one of the ways that I describe the book is I think of it as like the structure of the book as being like Russian nesting dolls of brokenness, that this is, you know, a consciousness in a broken body living. Another big piece of the book is that he's a new homeowner, and the new homeownership has been a disaster. He's living in a broken house, in a broken country, on a broken planet. And all of those brokennesses put pressure on the others, and all those pressures come to bear on this body lying in the bed. So in that sense, I mean, it's absolutely a book that is about a particular political movement or moment, excuse me, a particular political moment. But it is that not, it accesses that not through some political intention or ideology, but instead through the particular embodied experience of this man confronting mortality.
And writing the body.
Writing the body, yeah.
Which is writing also, which you clearly are doing, the mindscape. Like the body is the mind.
Absolutely. That's right. To write, and this is something I talk about with my students all the time, like students who are interested in writing interiority, you have to also be interested in writing the body. You know, there's a wonderful writer named Emer McBride, an Irish writer, is one of my favorite writers. And she, I heard her say once that she rejects the term stream of consciousness.
Oh, God.
And wants to think instead about stream of existence. And it's true, when you read her work, you see how she is trying to present not just the mind, you know, not just like a transcript of like thinking, but also bodily sensations and the external world as it impedes upon the body and all of these affordances. Like, that's what she wants to write. And I find that hugely exciting as a project.
And that's what's happening in Small Rain.
I mean, I would love to think that.
Well, it is. It
Thank
is.
You.
So we have only a couple of moments left. So I wanted to ask you about how your cats are doing.
Ah, thank you. I'm so happy. I miss them so much when I'm on the road. So I'm so happy to talk about my cats.
What are their names?
So we have two boys. They're two rescue kitties that we got during the pandemic. And one of them is named Oppen, after the poet George Oppen, who plays an important role in Small Rain. And the other one, who was named by my partner, is named Pedro. And they are the light of my life, yeah.
What's, do they have like one of their latest antics or so?
Well,
or?
You know, so they have beds on my desk. So I
hope it's a big desk.
It is. It's a big corner desk, that, although it's not in a corner, but it's a corner desk, but it has the L shape. And so on either end, they have, each of them has a bed. And it is a joy to be a writer. I get to sit and have them present. And I have a Substack called To a Green Thought, and I'm about to post a Substack about writing this Baldwin essay, which was the most difficult essay I've ever written. And I'm going to include a picture from the weeks when I was working, when I finally figured out how to write the essay, that is just my hand with Pedro's paw on top of my hand. And it's true that, like, that was how I would sort of take a breath when I was feeling anxious about what I was working on or despairful, you know, just to have Pedro sort of hold my hand and take a breath.
Share some energy.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Garth, thanks so much for talking today.
No, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
And for returning to Ann Arbor. And please come back again. And thanks, I should say, thanks to Julie Kedman and Kim and all the Zell Visiting Writers series for bringing you here. Folks, you can go and see and hear Garth tomorrow at UMA at 5:30. And then again on Friday at the Union for the craft lecture. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to Sarah Picador for sending the book. Thanks everyone out there for listening and being here with us today for this conversation. And thanks you too, Mom, for listening. Until next time, I'm T. Hetzel.
Your radio is on. It's on 88.3 FM, WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor's 24-hour open-minded radio surprise pudding, licensed to the Regents of the University of Michigan, operated by students at the University of Michigan, uniquely maintained as a healthy alternative and a positive influence on the mental health of the Ann Arbor community. You are here.
I could swallow.
WCBN not only does it
hold my breath and count to a zillion
discussion and music to
stand back. I can fly.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
I can stretch and stretch for a million billion.
You've got the bragging rights to the best.
In miles till I'm the highest.
Turn off the microphone.
Man in the world. Yeah, well, I could become a giant robot.
Oh, hi, this is Lee from Sonic.
But with magic death. Rays. That's nothing, man. I can't be burnt. Like, I could eat flame and stick my head
in. Oja? And when I'm in there,
in an oven and close the door.
Tune in next week.
You liar.
All right, it's time for some levity. This is the Drive Time Variety Hour, we'll call it, right here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I got an iron neck. And I'm DJ Ish. So I'll be here for the next hour, spinning just some nonsense, at least for the first 30 minutes, and then some solid polka. So don't go anywhere. Who knows what will happen? But thanks so much, Boots Randolph, getting us kicked off with some yakety sax. So don't go anywhere.